Hamilton is the 2015 Broadway Rags to Riches musical about Alexander Hamilton, based in large part on the thick 2004 biography of Hamilton written by Rod Chernow. Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote Hamilton and, at least in the initial runs, plays the part of the so-called founding father and guy on the $10 bill. You can see it on stage if you're rich, but if you're like most Americans, you can only afford to watch bootleg recordings or listen to the full soundtrack on YouTube while reading the lyrics. The first act introduces his early life as an orphan on a small island in the Caribbean. Several people die on him, and his enterprising intellect and business acumen are recognized and wins him patronage and passage to New York. There he went to school, ultimately King's College, which he withdrew from to actually serve in the war firing cannons in New York. He eventually becomes Washington's right-hand man and later helps put down the Whiskey Rebellion in the early 1790s. He meets, courts, and marries upper-class Elizabeth Schuyler. Hamilton and older Schuyler sister Angelica also have a fondness for each other that they never really realize. By the end of Act One, Hamilton's son Philip is born, Hamilton becomes the first Secretary of the Treasury, and writes over half of the Federalist Papers defending the power of the federal government, and Angelica moves to London. While the first act sets up a lot of his personal story, the second act is about more historical and ideological subjects. There are a few cabinet battles where, before Daddy George Washington, Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison argue about establishing a national bank, assisting the French in warring with Britain, and ending slavery. At a private party, these same dudes want to make a deal to accept Hamilton's national financial plans in exchange for moving the capital of the U.S. from New York to the Potomac River. Hamilton continues to work too much, his wife complains he's never around, and he's beginning to have a regular affair with Maria Reynolds, which comes back and bites him in the butt when he's blackmailed for it. After his fateful duel with Aaron Burr, the end is an epilogue about his wife continuing his supposed work against slavery. Well, this show's won 11 Tony Awards and was nominated for 17. It won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 2016. It's making millions and millions and millions of dollars. It's taught in high school and college classes on theater as well as history. Obama even jokes that liking the musical is the only thing he agrees with Dick Cheney on. What's wrong with this universal praise, or what's it avoiding in Hamilton?
Well, the universal praise is not as universal as it initially was. There have been some disputes about the play. Of course, the main thing that has made it special and distinctive is that all of the characters, except for George III, are played by people of color. So George Washington is black, and Hamilton is black, and Aaron Burr, right? They're all people of color, although there are not actual people of color in the story. So what it does is make the line that Miranda likes to use, that people have used, is it's about America then, but it's for America now, or about America now. But of course, it's accepting a very particular notion of the history of America. It acknowledges that part of what's really important in history is who gets to tell the story, who tells your story, is something that comes up. So while there are some lovely things in this, there's sparkling wit in much of the wordplay, and the music is catchy, and I really like that Immigrants, We Get the Job Done song, because there's not a lot of good said about immigrants in mainstream culture these days, so it's nice to have something. But there's a lot missing here, like actual people of color in the historical story.
Some critics, you know, want to defend or apologize for the play as history for today, but it's, you know, really actually an old way of looking at history, this great man of history, this, you know, the founding fathers in particular, as like, who were these guys and why do they, you know, keep overdetermining everything about how we live our lives today?
And what really were their motives? I mean, there's a lot of gesturing toward freedom and liberty and getting rid of the British. But the sort of freedom story is always vexed by, well, there is that slavery thing, which gets mentioned a few times but never fully addressed. And it's not clear that Hamilton was as much of an abolitionist as Ron Chernow would like to present him as being. I mean, if you put this up against something like the history that we get in Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's Indigenous Peoples' History of America, or Loaded, her history of the Second Amendment, you get a very different picture, because there, right, part of the motive for the American Revolution is that colonists kept moving into indigenous people's territory and consequently having conflicts and having wars, and the British government was getting tired of sending in troops to defend them from the native peoples. And so the colonists wanted to be free to take over more territory that belonged to the people who had been here first. And that's not mentioned at all. That's completely outside the picture. So we're getting a very particular narrative that fits with the old style great man, it's all about liberty, rah-rah. And Washington comes off particularly well in the play. I mean, he's like, as you say, Daddy George Washington. He's the grown-up in the room. He's the level-headed one. There's sort of no critique of him. He did own slaves. He did not free them until he died. His wife still had them after that. He was a surveyor. He was mainly interested in measuring and taking land. So Washington is maybe not all that, but he seems to be in the play.
And Hamilton himself has for a long time been recognized as someone who's an elitist, who is on the side of the rich, and his notions anyway of who the betters are in the world, which align with a lot of the bourgeois revolutions that see ability and merit as being, you know, connected to financial fortunes. And his own story is this, you know, rags to riches. You know, 100 years later, it'd be called Horatio Alger. He bootstraps himself up, and they're trying to recuperate that story itself by like trying to tie it to this vaguely abolitionist sediment that comes to like its most full expression in one of these cabinet battles where basically they're actually talking about ending slavery, and you know, George Washington is called out as having slaves. Thomas Jefferson is waffling about it, and they're not really looking at these people as human, as people who need to have liberty like them. They're, you know, these political liabilities.
Yeah, the bootstraps immigrant story as a meritocracy story really implies that the people who are on top of the social hierarchy deserve to be there, and that they're there because they belong there, which is a really pernicious idea. And the idea that slavery is a minor problem, that like, well, they didn't get around to dealing with it, but it's not that big a deal, seems deeply problematic at this moment in our history, certainly. And yeah, Hamilton was pretty well known, has been known by historians as an authoritarian. He thought that the president of the U.S. should be president for life. In one of the incidents that's not included in the play, the Newburgh Conspiracy, after the Revolutionary War, veterans wanted to get paid. They had been, you know, given IOUs for their pay in what became the American Army, and they wanted to be paid. And Washington sort of proposed a deal where, okay, right, we'll pay them. But Hamilton held out and insisted that the bankers who held the scrip would get paid first, right? So he sort of sets the tone for the idea that you can't bail out Main Street until you've paid off Wall Street. I mean, that's his legacy. And that, I think, is also extremely pernicious at this historical moment. And some historians have commented that he's a sort of marker of how we think about our economy and our political relations. He ended up on the $10 bill during the Roaring Twenties, when Andrew Mellon was Secretary of the Treasury. During the Great Depression and the New Deal, he was talked about as sort of an example of a fascist before the existence of fascism, right? So it's a very different sort of notion. And now he's been recuperated by all of these neoliberals, including Obama.
So a big part of why we want to talk about this is because a lot of people like this, and we don't think that this is just garbage. There's obviously something really engaging about the performance, the lyrics, the music.
I mean, it's well done. It's a great spectacle. We're a few years late on getting on the bandwagon in that respect, but people love it, and they teach it in schools and high schools and colleges. And so, I mean, clearly there are things here that appeal to people, but, you know, there is no document of civilization that is not also a document of barbarism, as Walter Benjamin said, right? That the attractions of this play are not incompatible with its deep problems.
It's being touted as opening up kids to history, and that may happen, but part of that narrative, that way of even looking at what education is that it, you know, it aligns what's worth knowing with what is fun, with what is, you know, smooth in this way that an entertaining performance can put together for you. You can learn something, but, you know, it's kind of defined by the values of the medium.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's problematic about it in that respect is precisely this notion that it's inviting people of color to identify with the founding fathers and to see themselves in this story in ways that are not really, don't really fit with where they come into the story. And so I think that's really problematic in a lot of ways. It reminds me a little bit of, there was an old feminist text about American literature by Judith Federley called The Resisting Reader, where she talked about this notion of emasculation, I-M-M, masculation, that female readers would read these books and identify with male characters because they were the main characters. And so then you have to go as a reader through a process of, as a woman who's reading this, through a process of realizing, oh, that's not me. I'm supposed to be identified, you know, like I'm being aligned with this other character who's really not important. Or in this case, you know, I'm being aligned with the character Sally, right? The only slave who's mentioned is like, Jefferson mentions her name at one point and hands something off to her. And that's it, right? There are no other slaves, enslaved people, people of color, certainly no indigenous people in the play. So I think it's inviting people to identify with a story that is really pernicious if one is not one of, well, even if one is one of the founding oligarchic plutocratic class, it's pernicious. But it's also the case that if it's being taught, right, people can be having conversations like this about it and reading it against Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's work.
Yeah, I think another way to like read what's appealing about it against what is problematic is that this is another example of the music and musical labor of Black and brown bodies being harnessed to tell a white person's story, to tell the story of white people's interests.
I agree that that much of what works about this play and this musical is it's the way that it draws on hip-hop and rap and synthesizes that with a kind of older Broadway tradition, which itself, although predominantly white, had come out of earlier generations stealing the music of people of color. So there is a kind of distinctly American quality to the synthesizing of different traditions from different cultures and different people of different races and ethnicities and backgrounds that is part of what makes it work so well.
Yeah, I think one of the ways that it resonates with folks is by, you know, setting up at least for a time this tension in Hamilton between you're dedicating your life to the revolution, which eventually becomes his political career, versus your home life and the family itself.
This also brings up the question about the female characters who are primarily concerned with his private life, except when extortion and blackmail comes into it. And even there, it's really about a guy, Reynolds, the husband of
Maria Reynolds.
And the play has been criticized for the very stereotypical roles of the female characters who are, right, his muse, Angelica, his doting, devoted wife, Eliza, and like the Peggy, who just is the third in the girl group, and then Maria, the siren femme fatale, who seduces him. So those are fairly typical roles. I mean, they are, you know, beautifully performed. And another great thing about the play is that it does give roles to people of color and it's musically enjoyable and all of that. But it's not a story that really grapples with the ways that public and private male and female spheres were frequently separated and have historically been divided.
Yeah. And what I don't see talked about as much, but it like struck me, is the fact that this musical being about Alexander Hamilton ultimately like celebrates his death in a duel, but also his son Phillip's. And it it is, you know, today what we would call toxic masculinity, being dressed in this kind of noble, it's what they did in the day kind of thing.
Yeah, it has a sort of aura because it happened back in the day, and they had to stand up violently for their honor and wouldn't have been manly had they not done it. I mean, there's also stuff about Hamilton at the beginning wanting to get into the army, and he doesn't want to just be Washington's aide. He wants to go out and fight, which may or may not be true, but that, I mean, there is a kind of representation of that sort of violent masculinity that is also part of the American story.
Yeah, it's one way to, like, ground the story of this person who's also an outsider is the fact that they, you know, participated in this purifying violence that brings together the nation.
Good point. So we've been talking about Hamilton, the musical, and its very interesting, complicated relation to actual American history, contemporary popular culture, stuff like that.
You can find it on YouTube. It, you know, wouldn't be not worth the 2.5 hours. You know, check it out. We didn't even spend any time talking about the ridiculously priced tickets.
Yeah, they go for like $1,000. To their credit, they do a lottery for people to get cheap tickets, small number of less expensive tickets. They also have done subsidized tickets for kids in schools and classes of school children, and they've done some excerpts performed for free on the street outside the theater. So there's some attempt to make it accessible in a way that Broadway shows typically are not. But, I mean, insofar as this play has been described as saving Broadway, I'm not sure Broadway deserves to be saved.
For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Joe Clement and Fran Michel.
Shall I keep him? 'Twill come the day when I'll be weeping. But how can I love him any less? This little babe upon my breast. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. I've got a body dark and strong. But not for long. You took me to bed a little girl, left me in a woman's world. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my